Hello, dear listener, and welcome back to Flight Through Entirety, the only Doctor Who podcast that can smell David Tennant from the other side of the universe. I'm Nathan.
I'm Todd.
And I'm Simon.
Well, the fruit cup has run out, the band is nowhere to be seen, and we've been sitting here awkwardly for an entire week waiting for Mr. Smith to make his terrible decision. Who will live and who will die? Let's find out as we discuss the Family of Blood. You didn't notice that there didn't seem to be any visible band of any kind.
No, I did not. The music's just coming out of thin air.
It is.
I did not notice that.
Are you kidding me?
They're the first ones to be vaporized by
his gun. Oh, no way.
Yeah, they're not visible. It's basically a pretty lavish-looking production, I have to say, but there are some obvious cheaping out
moments. It's funny. I disagree with that. I'm not saying it doesn't look good. I'm just saying it doesn't look like they need to spend a lot of money on it because it's all easy.
Because it's all sort of locations and things.
Yeah, the church hall. And,
You know, they have a lot of background artists.
They do, yes, which is refreshing.
Yeah, that is kind of nice. And particularly in this episode because you've got the scene in the village hall and you've got, you know, a whole heap of
boys at the school.
The place seems populated.
And there are a lot of they must be sort of digitally kind of doubled or tripled or quadrupled or something. The scarecrows.
There
are a lot of them in the attack.
Yes. How do they make them again?
We don't know. But son of mine says that he created them.
Yes.
Very quickly.
Yes.
Who cares? But the thing is, though, that it's quite clear he's taken the template of one and somehow duplicated. It's not like every farmer in the area has the same looking scarecrow.
Yes, I guess
that's the implication, true. Is that he's also stitched them together.
Or Anthony only turns up.
dusting the hay off.
What do we think of the scarecrows?
I think they're brilliant, and I think they're brilliant because of the way they move. The weird lumbering where you're not sure which bits are joined, you know, where is the shoulder, where is the elbow, and I think that's quite effective.
They've got very sort of floppy limbs as if they have no bones.
As if they're made of straw, yeah.
And I think the face too, which is very kind of skull-like.
Yes, and the stitching over the lips and things.
Yeah.
It's quite grotesque, actually.
We have had scarecrows before, but they've always been sort of adjacent to Doctor Who, not really in the actual show. So you remember that the second Doctor meets his demise at the hands of some scarecrows in the comics in season 6B. Right. And I think Doctor Who meets Scratch Man. Does that have some scarecrows in it? I think it probably does. So we've never had them before, and this is a story that would otherwise completely lack non-human monsters, isn't it?
Yes.
So if you want merch or if you want things for the kids to be frightened
action figures.
Of, yeah, you need them, I think.
And
wasn't
as
there
usual.
Wasn't there a straw Queen of the May in an episode?
No, that was Tegan.
But as usual, and I've said this before and I'll say it again if I'm given the opportunity, the best Doctor Who stories often have no or the monster is the sideline. The real villain is a human or humanoid type figure.
Well, I mean, we do get that here.
Exactly.
Yeah.
That's what I'm saying.
It's a thing.
The scarecrows are just window dressing.
Yeah. Well, it's a thing that Holmes does very often, isn't it?
Yep.
Where he's given some stupid monster and he's sort of fairly confident that they're not going to be able to realise it properly. And so he makes the humans the villains.
Yeah.
And he's doing it all the way back.
Yeah.
From
whether it's Harrison Chase, whether it's you know, Talons of Wing Chiang, Pyramids of Mars, even, you know, you've got Sutek. It's a voice. I mean, you know, he's for all intents and purposes humanoid. The mummies are just window dressing.
Yeah. Yeah, I think they're effective. I think they look really good. Those scenes where they attack Mr. Clark and Lucy Cartwright in last week's episode, I thought they were really effective.
Yes.
Here they work really well kind of thematically. Because we get that attack on the school, and one of the things that we haven't really properly mentioned is that the spectre of World War One hangs over this, and the boys are training in a sort of army cadets unit-like sort of posh, expensive schools in Sydney now have army cadets units still, you know.
Mm. I don't think they have machine guns, though.
They tend not to, no.
But we had a rifle range at school.
Yes, but we didn't have a machine gun. I mean, you know, we shot six bullets or something like that.
Have you shot a gun?
Yes.
Yes, we did cadets at school.
Oh, wow. Yeah. Okay. It wasn't compulsory at my school. Yeah. So these are boys who will be being killed in a year's time. Mm. You know, like it's going to be 1914 and they're going to be fighting in France or whatever. I think they had originally intended to set this before World War II, but decided to set it before World War I, partly I think because during production the story got closer and closer to the original novel. Like,
oh, it started further away. Yeah.
I think so. And Paul says that, you know, he would hand the script to Russell and Russell will say, but what about this bit in the novel I really liked? and so he would put it in. And so it's, you know, there are ways in which it's quite far away from the novel, but there are ways in which it is quite close, particularly the ending, which we'll talk about a little bit later. But that scene where the boys are being given the guns and that's when they're really young. You know, Hutchison and Baines are clearly adults, played by adults, but the background artists aren't.
No.
They're all very young.
Yeah,
But what – I don't know whether you're about to go there about the way they mow the scarecrows down.
Yeah.
You see, that is very World War One.
Yeah.
The mowing down. And they are – you know, mowing down people as if they are just scarecrows.
Yeah, and the boys are crying. Like, while they're doing it, the boys are crying. And even Hutchison, who has been, like, horrible, like is a sort of horrible person in the first episode, is shaken as well. Mm. So you see these shots of boys with tears in their eyes gunning people down.
Isn't the To Be a Pilgrim song playing over the top of that?
Yeah, yeah. Yeah, and again, that's, you know, World War One is big European Christian empires killing millions of each other's citizens, you know, like the Christianity can't be kind of separated from it, I think.
It's interesting in that whole sequence that the doctor, John Smith, doesn't appear to fire a gun.
Yeah, and he puts the gun down. I think it's more explicit in the novel again where he doesn't shoot, but I don't think we could have tolerated seeing the doctor gunning people down.
Mm. No, but the thing about the World War One thing, I mean, I can understand because no one in 1913 or even in April 1914 would have had any idea in terms of the people in charge, quote unquote, would have had any idea that there was about to be war. It was such a weird, stupid, peculiar series of events and treaties activating and all this kind of other nonsense that got them into it. Whereas I think if it was 1938, say,
we would have known it was coming.
Yes, because everyone's got that sense there is war coming, because this is all going on in Europe. So I think it can work that they're gunning down all these scarecrows and that's kind of a premonition of World War One without them all thinking, oh, war is coming, because no one thought that.
Well, Baines thinks it, though, and so he sees himself as sort of, you know, prefiguring World War One in that scene by sending his soldiers to be shot down by children whom he knows will be fighting.
But that's just because he knows the future.
Yeah, because he's, you know, a space guy or whatever. And, you know, his reason for knowing about the war is sort of fairly thin, but it does sort of need to be there. And the story is very positive about World War One, I think, in a sense. Not positive about World War One in the sense that it was a good thing and let's have more of them.
Yeah.
But the only person who expresses reservations about the war isn't the doctor, it's Baines. Do you remember when he dresses down the headmaster and says, you know, what are they going to think of you when you've taught them to be in a war like this? What will they think of the man who taught them this was glorious as they're all being gunned down? And giving that idea that the First World War is in some sense sort of futile or pointless or some horrible cheat that's sort of perpetrated on the populations, the unwitting populations of all of these countries, that gets given to Bates and no one else expresses that. For everyone else, we imagine that they see this as fighting the king's enemies. And certainly when
the king and country.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. And that's how that scene with the scarecrows is couched. It's couched in those terms. They speak about fighting the king's enemies and defending his properties and stuff when they're fighting off the scarecrows.
Mm.
Joan, of course, knows a bit, has read the Doctor's diary and John Smith's diary, I should say, and he references 1914 and what is to come. So she's got, in her talk with the Doctor, she knows that it's wrong for the boys to fight, or John Smith knows.
Yeah, yeah, and she would like to think that John Smith thinks that too, even though last week she very nearly puts an end to the relationship, I think, when she sees him training the boys to shoot. It's just after John Smith says to Hutchison that he can beat Latimer. Mm. Yeah. And she kind of walks away and says, look, I was remembering my husband who died. And so she is the one, I guess, expressing reservations. But everyone else thinks war is really quite glorious at this point.
Mm. Make a man of you.
Yeah.
Well, I wish they'd make a man of Latimer, because he does resolve the cliffhanger resolution with opening the watch, and that gives Martha the opportunity to seize the gun and take control of that situation. Yes.
It has to be Martha, though, doesn't it? You can't have the John Smith, the human John Smith, resolve the cliffhanger, can you?
No, because that's the point of the cliffhanger.
Yeah, yeah.
But it's another reason why she's so good in these episodes. She's got so many great moments, and her sass comes back in this episode, like in her bits of dialogue, like, God, you're rubbish as a human.
Oh, I've got that written down here too.
And then with Nurse Redfern, when she doesn't believe that she's training to be a doctor, and she goes, oh, you think? Like, yeah. I just love the fact that she's standing up.
In fact, those are my favourite sort of Martha Lyon readings, I think, where she's just a little bit kind of sassy and naughty. Like, she tends to be quite a good girl, but every so often she hits back with a zinger, and I think Freema plays that really well.
It's something in my rewatch that, you know, she's under control most of the time, she's handling a situation, but every so often she lets that little bit of a fire out, and I really, really love it. And it's why she's my MVP for these episodes. Mm. And, of course, later on in this episode, you know, as the Doctor sort of – I keep saying the Doctor, but it's as John Smith keeps saying, like putting it down, what exactly do you do for him? And she has to justify that. And she says, he's everything to me and I love him to bits, but he won't even look at me. That moment is glorious.
Well, in fact, I quite like her bit of dialogue saying, I really hope that he doesn't remember this, because she's sort of genre aware to some degree.
Yes, yes.
And it turns out he does remember it, and they do have an awkward moment discussing it at the end, which is kind of funny.
Kind of quite cute. We did touch a little bit in last week's episode about Harry Lloyd's performance as Baines. It is so good when he becomes possessed as Son of Mine, or reanimated, or whatever he is. But it's aided by the direction, by the shot choices, by the choice of lens, the way when they're doing the sniffing thing. And it's really fast and sharp, and it cuts to this I don't know whether it's a fisheye type lens almost, but it's really – it's from the side, and it accentuates the shape of his face in a way to make it look – because he's quite attractive, right? He's a very attractive bloke, but they kind of deform the shape of his face to make it like unnatural, that, you know, this is not Baines anymore. This is not a human. This is an animated corpse.
He's in the – Merlin, isn't he? Isn't he a regular in Merlin?
Well,
he's in the first season of Game of Thrones as Daenerys' brother, and he meets a terrible fate there.
Because I remember,
but again, upper class twit in the same way.
Yeah. But he's not like that in real life, actually. And I
think we had to eat it. I was reading.
Well, but he doesn't look like that. Do you know what I mean? He looks much more relaxed. He was sort of bearded and stuff in Confidential, possibly. And I think he was
everyone's bearded now.
Yeah, well, no, but I think he was in a regular kind of genre program and did seem to be a little bit more relaxed. Not like that at all, but the performance is really, really fun. Yeah. And he's adopted all that sort of shouty military crap from the headmaster and from his teachers and stuff.
Yes.
And so he comes back and brings that back to them.
Yeah. I'm really surprised that he hasn't done more like that I can remember, like in terms of film and that sort of thing. Like, it's now been 11, 12 years. And I'm really surprised.
Mm. And it's a shame that in Game of Thrones he gets killed, because in some respects if that character hadn't have been killed a few episodes into the first season of Game of Thrones, he probably would have gone on to great and glorious things, being catapulted from Game of Thrones like it's done for so many of the others.
Yeah, I don't know why I'm not remembering what he's been in, because I just kind of think he has been in things, but I've just sort of missed them. But there is a glorious shot. I don't know if it's him and Mother of Mine. It's a high shot, like taken from the school or somewhere, and they're standing. And it doesn't look like him. It literally does. I thought this is a stand-in actor. Mm. I had to pause the thing. And it is him, but just the way it's totally framed, he's so alien. He is so good. But I also think Jenny is also great. And there's a reason why those two are the central figures. I think they cut around that little girl a bit. And the father's competent.
But if I can say too, they all, but particularly Baines and Jenny too, they manage to chew the scenery without eating the entire thing. The best Doctor Who villains are the Harrison Chasers, and who I keep coming back to, I know. It is a camp performance. It's over the top. But it works in the context, and there's a very, very, very fine line that has to be walked to make it work and to not make it look like it's hammy. And I think it's achieved by a director who maybe knows when to say just dial it back a fraction there, darling, or something, and also using the shots and editing in a way so that it doesn't become dominant. You know, otherwise it does look like Paul Darrow in Time Lash.
I think they do a great job. Mm. I think they all of them do, but obviously they concentrate on the two strongest ones. They're really, really terrific and absolutely kind of off-putting, because it's an off-putting performance, off-putting performance. The director is, of course, Charles Palmer, who is the son of Doctor Who alumnus Jeffrey Palmer.
He'll be turning up in one of his son's episodes very, very soon.
Yeah, so he directs Voyage of the Damned, where Jeffrey Palmer drives the Titanic into an iceberg. But he'd obviously been in the Doctor Who in the 70s sort of quite a lot, and was a sort of terribly famous sitcom actor. So Charles Palmer's his son, and I think he's extremely good. I think he does a great job. I like the choice of giving the family of blood no visible alien characteristics, but giving them a sort of a green colour, because the colour of aliens is green. Mm. And so whenever they talk to one another telepathically, we just get a green light on their face.
Mm.
And it's just a practical light. It's not a post-production effect or anything.
Right. I'd forgotten all of that. It's one of my mental blackouts. Yeah. But no, honestly, I'd forgotten that was the way in which they communicated. I do have to say one thing at this point. Yeah. We've been praising this episode, and we'll praise it, the ending, and we'll praise, I think you love the music. But I have to say, this is the first episode of New Who that I actually was disappointed in. I came in with an expectation.
The first.
Mm. I came in with an expectation of what I was going to get. Mm-hmm. And I guess I've had various expectations of other episodes, some very low, and they've lived up to those expectations. But with this one, I came in thinking, this is going to be knocking it out of the ballpark all throughout the episode. And about, 10 minutes in, I was just beginning to lose hope. From two perspectives. One was John Smith and him going on and on and on about why can't I stay, and I just wanted it to stop. Mm-hmm. And the other one was Latimer with the watch. How many times can you open that thing or run away to a different location? And I just found that personally, I just thought the episode was marking time for 10 minutes, 15 minutes. I'm going, I just want this thing resolved. I know that sounds slack, because I think this is a good episode. I actually enjoy overall this episode, and the last 10 minutes I think are extraordinary. But I did have a problem in this middle part of the episode.
I certainly think that Latimer keeping the watch is just spinning the episode out. You know, when he finally surrenders the watch, and I think he's even asked, why didn't you do it before?
Yeah.
And he says, the watch wasn't ready. Mm. The watch told me. And that does seem to be kind of artificially delaying things a bit. And I do think that scene where Nurse Redfern takes them to that house and then they just sit around talking for a very, very long time, I think that starts to wear out its welcome a little bit. I do think that scene is really good. I love the idea that it was little Lucy Cartwright's house and her family have all been murdered.
Her father, yes. It's very nicely done and very subtle, and it's that thing of that there are consequences.
Yeah.
I'm sorry, but I've forgotten. I didn't even remember. I just thought, this little girl's dead. Her family are going to be devastated. And then they said, oh, no, she's actually murdered them all.
Yeah.
And I'm just there going, well, that's something new I discovered.
And the teapot's ice stone cold.
Yeah.
No. It's quite gruesome, actually, and in a nice underplay sort of way. It's very well known.
And thanks to Jessica Hines, I think, because she's the one who properly sells it, because the idea is that she has already worked out that this has happened.
Yes.
She goes to that house because she knows it will be deserted, because she knows that daughter of mine will have killed Lucy Cartwright's entire family.
And is unlikely to return there.
And I think she says, you know, how quickly we come to accept these things or something like that.
Yes.
And that will pay off. And I think it matters that so much of the episode takes place there, because it's just a reminder of what has happened. Mm. And at the end of the episode, where Joan gets to speak to the doctor himself.
Ah, that one, yes.
It really pays off.
It does.
Yeah.
And in fact, it's interesting. She's, well, because one imagines she has an apartment at the school, so she doesn't have a house. And so she's sort of sitting in that house. It's nice because it adds an extra location. And I think that it's nice when you get that, you know, the new location appears in, you know, episode 3 or something and takes you through to the end. It's like the new home base, and it's somewhere where you think the characters can feel safe when the world around them is totally going to hell. If I can just sort of come to, and Todd, you touched on it with Tennant's performance as John Smith. He starts last week's episode with a bit of 1913 acting in a pretty minor tokenistic way. And I think, especially during the second episode, it does descend into it just being the normal David Tennant performance of the Doctor. There could be reasons for this, and I know there's artistic choices and they're all valid and so on. But it was when I was watching the second episode that I felt that there was a missed opportunity for both the program and for Tennant himself as an actor. When you consider Patrick Troughton's performance as Salamander in Enemy of the World. Now, I know Salamander is actually a different character, whereas, this is actually supposed to just be, you know, a watered-down version of the Doctor. But this could have been a beautiful way for him to get rid of the stupid gelled hair and have a very kind of slicked 1913 Edwardian, early Georgian sort of hairstyle, for him to speak much more poshly than he does, and much more kind of middle, in that very middle class version of posh, particularly in the sort of the early 20th century. And also for his character at that moment where they've got to decide, are we going to open the watch or are we not? You've got to do this. And she's the one who has to convince him. And I know that's part of it, that, you know, she's the one being strong. But surely the human John Smith would be very stoic and, I've got to do this for king and country.
Yeah.
I've got to sacrifice myself, rather than going to pieces a little bit.
I don't think I agree with you about Tennant's performance, but I do agree with you about, you know, like, about that choice. Like, I think Tennant really, really differentiates John Smith from his normal performance as the Doctor. And there's that moment, remember, when he's holding the watch and then he tells Tim why it is that he's got precognition and, oh, my God, the Doctor's back. And we haven't really seen Tennant do that in that outfit at all. And Tennant's outfit is a modified version of his normal outfit.
Yes.
With
same colour scheme and
Like, the tie looks like it's a version of one of his normal ties that's kind of been chopped up and turned into a bow tie in this sort of final episode. So I think he does maintain a big distinction between the two characters, but I don't like the mewling, crying performance that John Smith does, and I do think a bit more bravery would have been, or anger perhaps. Yes. You know, if it had been anger, but it's blubbing, and I just
find, it's blubbing. You're right. It's
and
blubbing.
I just find myself with very little sympathy for it, particularly as it goes on and on. And, you know, we're getting to the point where, you know, they're raining down destruction on the entire village, where there's, you know, space bombs raining down everywhere, and he's still crying about it.
Because he should be the distilled nature of who the Doctor is, even if he's been turned into a human, should be about what's the right thing to do. I will sacrifice myself. He does it. The David Tennant Doctor at the end of his reign does that. He sacrifices himself. The Doctor's always sacrificing himself at the end, mainly when it comes to regenerations and stuff. It's a shame that Joan has to convince him that that's the right thing to do.
I think that anger would have been appropriate as well, but I guess what I do like is that Joan's anger only really, really properly becomes apparent when she's faced with the Doctor.
Yes.
At the end. And I think that's so amazing. The bit where she says, "Would anyone have died if you just hadn't decided to come here on a whim?"
And that is, I think, perhaps the only time in the program, one of the few times in the program, certainly, where they use those sorts of lines and it's true.
Yeah.
Because the Doctor has actually come to this village to escape, to hide, right? He's not because the alien menace has dragged him there or he happens to have arrived there and discovered the alien menace. He has brought the alien menace to this place.
Often when it's, you know, like the Doctor turns up and, you know, it's a thing in the program, isn't it? The Doctor's dangerous, the Doctor turns up and
it's so
happens,
overdone and I hate it.
And it's never his fault really or whatever.
Yeah.
But here, every single death, like, you know, we've spent so much time in a house where the entire family's dead and that's the Doctor's fault.
It is.
And she just says, "Go away." You know, like, she's furious with him and doesn't overplay it at all.
No.
But it's just, "Get out." You know, like, "I'm not going to travel with you because you are a monster who put me through this and put everyone else through it."
Yeah.
The fact that the Doctor even asks her to travel with me, I think is
clueless.
Yes,
absolutely clueless and absolutely galling. And, you know, and she says that's not fair.
Yes.
She's already said that she can't bear to look at it.
She tells him off.
Jessica Hines' performance in this is just sublime. She is amazing. The characterization and the way that it's written as well and directed, but without her having that inner strength and that insight throughout all these episodes.
It's a mark of a very good actor because what she's done is she's looked at the script, she's looked at the reasons why this character is saying the words that they are, and she's got the thought process of what is this character thinking at this time, and you can see it written on her face.
So I was complaining about the middle part of the episode. We're now talking about the back end of the episode, all these wonderful scenes with Martha, with Nurse Redfern. There's also just the brilliant montage of the life that could have been.
That was the cheat that I was talking about because that's in the next time trailer, as if the Doctor is going to have
the rest of his
days. Yeah.
That's all right then.
But I love that. I adore that sequence and it pulls at your heartstrings.
And notice that they both see it. Like, she sees it too. Yeah. So she sees what both of them are giving up.
Do you feel that they almost experience an entire life in those few seconds?
It's the inner light.
It's the inner light, exactly. And like 50, 60 years pass in the blink of an eye. Or do you think it's just flashes?
We see what they see. Because if they get to experience that life, then having it taken away from them doesn't happen. You know, the thing is heartbreaking because they both know what they could have and they don't get it, you know. And that's the Doctor's fault. That's entirely the Doctor's fault that doesn't happen. So I think if they got it in some kind of science fiction sense, that would kind of undermine that a bit. Mm. I think it's terribly good. It's well known that John Smith's final words, you know, "Is everyone okay?" Or his sort of near final words is based on something that Paul's father once said when he was ill. The first thing, you know, that he says is "everyone okay?" And so he remembers that. There's some shockingly insightful things about grief, I think, in the novel. Yeah, and we'll get back to that later. But I do think that it is the first hint of some horrifying developments to come with the aging makeup.
Oh, at the end of the season.
Yeah, 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 yeah.
Oh, that I think the aging makeup here is okay.
Mm. Well, yeah, I watched it on Blu-ray on a 60-inch television last night. It didn't really hold up all that well. But it is there quite briefly, I think, so we'll give it a pass. But it's going to be kind of the foam machine, the BBC foam machine of series three, I think, and
it's going to get more,
series two.
It's going to get more horrific. So the Doctor goes to the spaceship, pretending to be John Smith, and fumbles around and accidentally pushes a lot of different buttons. And then by doing that, the spaceship's going to blow up, and so the family of mine become utterly useless at that point and just have to run outside and let their spaceship blow up. And then the Doctor can just then become the most powerful being in the universe and put people in unbreakable chains, put them in the event horizon of a collapsing galaxy, trapping one of them inside a mirror and suspending son of mine in time in the fields of England. If he's that powerful, why doesn't he just do this all the time to every single villain?
I think that that scene is very strange. I think it's extremely good.
When you say the scene where he presses the buttons or the aftermath?
So the aftermath. So the scene where he presses the buttons, I think that that is
wonderful.
Yeah, yep. And it gives Tennant the chance to do some, you know, fun acting. And you're relieved, I think, whatever you think about David Tennant's normal performance as the Doctor, you do feel relieved when the Doctor's back and he is sort of funny and wonderful. And that line, "You shouldn't have let me press all those buttons," you know, he's fallen on a bunch of buttons. I think that works really well. But then after that, that scene where you get a voiceover from Baines himself, from Son of Mine, explaining to us what ended up happening to them. But I don't know exactly why it's there. And I think it exposes a kind of problem with the whole setup. And we've talked about this before, and we'll talk about it next week because it's an important feature of next week's episode. The Family of Blood have the characteristics they have because Paul Cornell wants to tell this story. And so the fact that they're like mayflies, that they'll just die in a few months.
Mm. 3 months.
Yeah, yeah.
I've got it written down here.
Is just there to make this plot work. We have the Doctor pursued by monsters who haven't seen him for some reason and who he just needs to prevent them from catching up with him for sort of 3 months and then and the they'll run out of energy. But
do they die after 3 months? How do they build a spaceship? Is it somebody else's spaceship? Is it their technology?
I assume they've nicked the spaceship or something.
Right. And then when they inhabit somebody, do they last for 3 months or is it the lifespan of that person?
No, it's the lifespan of that. I think the 3 months is the lifespan of their
natural
of their life cycle, their gaseous, whatever it is, the green glowiness, whatever it is. But
yeah.
Look, I get what you're saying, and you did sort of say that when we were doing Girl in the Fireplace, that the universe or the world is a contrivance just so you can tell the story that wants to be told.
Correct.
I don't think that's a sort of fair thing because that's exactly what we're paying them, everyone's paying them to do, to tell us these stories. And the whole of Doctor Who is set up so that these stories can be told.
I think, though, that
Game of Thrones, anything we watch.
But there's a sort of fridge logic to this. You know, like it's only after the episode's over and then you're at the fridge getting something and you think, wait, how do these people even exist properly if they only have a 3 month lifespan or something like that? Like, I'm happy that they get to tell this story. Well, and you have to. That's the thing. It's not the premise of Human Nature, the novel, where
They don't have 3 month life.
No, what they have is they create families that are just eight people. There's eight of them instead of four in this. And if they can assimilate a Time Lord, then each of them can regenerate and create their own families and stuff, and they'll eventually take over the entire world. And the Doctor doesn't, I think, necessarily know that they're chasing him, although I might be wrong about that. But here, you know, they have to set up a fairly special and complex reason why he chooses to, you know, go through the transformation arch and
I think that's the weakest part of it is why he actually needs to make this extraordinary decision in the first place. But I buy that. That for me is the problem, if there is a problem.
Yeah. I mean,
if I can compare this to an offline discussion we've had about gridlock.
Yeah.
Why is this a kind of contrivance so that we can tell the story we want to tell, but being caught in a traffic jam for 28 years or whatever it is in gridlock, why is that not a contrivance?
Oh, no, I think they both are. And I think that I'm not saying that those contrivances are things that shouldn't happen.
Right.
And I do think that whatever it takes to tell the Doctor Who as Superman 2 story, whatever it takes, I'm happy for us to just go through that. Okay. But it is sort of, it's a bit thin, I think.
Why does the Doctor need to have these people live forever in these situations? Can't they just live out there, put them somewhere?
It's the gruesome punishment.
If he took them to the planet Kolkakron, you know, just to live out their last month.
Like a Tractator or something.
Yeah. You know, then, like, that's a thing he could have done. And it would have been sort of less interesting and obviously less poetic and less effective. But why does he make them live forever? Like,
okay, that's the thing. Like, why can't we just have them live out their lives trapped in those things for the punishment for what they've done, and that's enough?
So
they live out their lives as the humans that they've taken over.
Yeah, so the Doctor is initially, we discover, being kind. That's why he became human, because his only way of dealing with them was to make them immortal. And
no, I think my interpretation, and this is from not me trying to retcon explain it all away, this is just my impression, is that these are a form of immortal being, but they only have existence in our universe or existence as a sort of a sentient being for very short stretches of time, and then maybe millions of years might go past, and then they'll kind of coalesce again and be able to have 3 months of life. Kind of like, you know, those frogs that live at the bottom of dry creek beds in the desert, and they can hibernate there without water for like 3 or 4 years, and then there's a shower of rain and the pond fills up, and then they go through an entire life cycle where they breed and they have babies, and then they all rot and die in the drying creek bed, and then their babies come back to life, the eggs hatch in 4 or 5 years time when the next rain comes. I see them as that sort of entity where they're not necessarily having children, but they are only having these moments, these flashes of existence, and they are trapped in a sort of immortality. So I don't think the Doctor's making them live forever at the end. I think he's dealing with the fact that he doesn't want them to then come back again in another however many thousands of years' time, millions of years' time.
So they already live forever.
And
this way, to stop them from doing bad things, they are then trapped.
Yeah, they already live forever, but they can't have more than a few months at a time.
But except that they were going to die. They were going to die in another month, and then the Doctor could have gone off and just said that the threat was over.
I don't think they said die. I think they said that they will cease to be or cease to...
Yeah, you know, but the threat goes away at that point. Then the Doctor can just go off. Yeah.
But that still works with my theory.
Yeah. I guess the fact that the episode itself just says that they're going to stop and the Doctor just has to wait out the end of their lives.
Yeah.
And that's the solution. Like, I don't know why that still doesn't work once the Doctor's the Doctor again. Like, if he's blown up their spaceship, they can't go anywhere. They're on the planet Kolkakron with the Gravis. And
you think they should just keel over?
They die in a few months' time.
Yeah.
And so he seems to be imposing immortality on them, and it seems to be a disproportionate reaction, like a disproportionate response. And I don't know why exactly Paul wants to make the Doctor so vengeful and so godlike. And I do think that Russell kind of wants to do this as well, like that the new series seeks to problematize the Doctor in various ways, and different showrunners have different ways of doing it. But this thing where he's a kind of vengeful monster, a little bit like the way that Matt Smith's Doctor is described in the Pandorica opens as well.
Yes.
You know, he'll drop out of the sky and tear down your world.
See, does this tie in with like what Donna experienced in the Christmas episode where he gets rid of all of the Ragnos's children? Where he goes too far. Like he's got all, he actually has all this power, and there are moments where he makes the wrong decision.
Which the companion holds him back.
Is this trying to demonstrate this to us when we're having a discussion about it.
Yeah, I guess that's it. I guess that is the same thing, isn't it? But it does seem really extraordinary, like really, really quite strange. And I certainly love the scenes, and I love how that voiceover is delivered, and I love how it's written. And, you know, like, he is talking to the audience. There's no other way of interpreting it. You know, he tells you what happens when you look in a mirror and you see a movement behind you.
Yes.
That's his sister. And I think all of that's great. And there's obviously a reference to Warrior's Gate in there with the dwarf star alloy and all of that sort of stuff. Like, it's epic, and it does make the Doctor into a sort of scary godlike figure, but it just...
Which is very New Adventures.
It is very New Adventures as well. It is very New Adventures, but it does seem like a fairly disproportionate response to just four people with lobster guns.
Yes. No, I'm prepared to acknowledge that, because that is the sort of thing that I didn't like about the New Adventures. It's the sort of thing I don't like about the new series when they do stray there, like you said, with the Pandorica opens and the Doctor is God, and the Doctor is this super powerful being, and also playing up the fact that, oh, the Doctor's an alien, therefore he has different morals to us, and therefore blah, blah, blah. But for some reason, I can just go with the flow. In fact, if I'm going to be uncomfortable with one element of it, it is the girl being trapped in the mirror, because it's a bit like, I mean, I know that's probably just a poetic way of saying that she's trapped between the dimensions or something, like, you know.
Yeah. It's magic. Doctor Who's full of magic.
Well, that's another reference to Warrior's Gate, one could argue.
Yeah, I guess so.
I don't like it when the Doctor Who strays too much into magic, though. I'd rather have a, you know, stupid explanation for why it happens.
Yeah.
Or I'd rather just have them all killed off in the spaceship.
Did you see Terror of the Zygons in that? I saw... I know it's completely different in so many ways, but maybe it's just the sort of the dull lighting of the spaceship and everything, and the bleeps and the bloops and all the kind of the knobbly bits that he presses. But it's when they're all running out and they're running from the spaceship and it blows up behind them. I just saw Terror of the Zygons.
That's a great observation. No, actually, I didn't see that, but now that you say it, I can clearly see it.
I think that the design of the spaceship owes something to it, don't you?
Yeah, like,
it's a little bit less rude, but...
Especially the outside.
Yeah.
I had heard that was a budget-saving measure that ended up being more expensive than it would have been if it was visible. But there is an invisible dome that the villains hang out in the novel as well.
Oh, so, is there? Yeah. Invisible dome, right? Yeah.
The endings, like after all of this.
The many endings.
The many endings. No, all the endings rescue this episode for me. It's all the endings. The fact that Joan keeps, you can see that she's going to keep the diary.
Yeah.
It's a subtle, lovely moment. I love the Doctor and Martha's awkward conversation, but the thank you is so, she's earned that thank you.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
Above and beyond. And then when the Doctor says, you'll love this bit to Tim. So he gets to see the dematerialization, and then of course we get the whole war sequence, which has been peppered throughout. Mm. And then the Doctor and Martha turning up to what may not be present day, but it might be, you know, 10 years ago or whatever, always brings a tear to my eye with him in the wheelchair there.
Mm. Yeah. Well, that's actually the scene that I was, one of the scenes that I was referring to, which wasn't in Paul's original script, but Russell remembered it from the novel, and so it's back. That's exactly how the novel ends. And, you know, it's absolutely perfect in that you've got age shall not weary them, all of that kind of thing. You've got this very old man who's got to be in his 90s. It can't possibly be 2007.
It could be 105.
Yeah, I guess
so. I reckon it's 1990-something.
I don't think it really matters.
No. Yeah.
It doesn't matter. It's the end of the 20th century.
And we've been through in the last few years the sort of centenary of World War One, and a kind of renewed appreciation, I think, of what people went through. And I think, you know, there's that British thing where people wear the poppy, you know, more than we do here, and certainly sort of
we
news
wear
presenters.
Branding,
yeah. But news presenters and stuff will wear the poppy
for
and
weeks,
politicians
yes.
and stuff like that. And I think that that's a pretty good thing to do. But it is It's odd. I do think it is slightly odd at the end of a story which has been mostly about gunning down scarecrows and, you know, David Tennant blubbing. But I guess it adds a sort of proper gravitas to the story.
I think it's a nice little coda. Doesn't need to be there. But given so much of the – there are so many references to the fact that, you know, World War One starts next year and all these young boys are going to be, you know, horrifically gunned down. And so, that's not just a glancing theme. They keep coming back to it, particularly with Tim. And I think it's nice to see that Tim's had a rich and full and long life. I mean, for me, the more annoying bit is the bit in the battle scene when the shell comes down and he dodges it, you know. That, for me, is the most tedious bit, actually.
Why?
Well, because it's just like, do we actually need to do that? I think we've seen it already in his little flashboard things, these little premonitions. Doing it again, it's just like everything has to be tied up with a little bow. As I said in the last episode, I started rereading the New Adventures, and at the end of Time Worm Revelation by Paul Cornell, which seemed very cool at the time, that he spends this last section of the book where he goes back and puts in place all the little newspaper ads and all these little things to make all of these little magical moments work in the early part of the book. And in some respects, it's just an unnecessary, let's tie it all up in a little bow and make it all neat. And I don't think it's really necessary.
It's funny, I've just been watching on Friday night with Peter, we watched Death to the Daleks. And at the end of that, the Doctor's just standing there with everybody else, and it's a close-up on him, and they haven't left, they haven't, you know, yes. The Daleks, you know, it just ends, and you know, okay, yes, well, they'll say their goodbyes, and they'll go, we don't get all that neatly tying up, we don't get to see, like, oh, Belal, come with us, but, you know, he doesn't get that opportunity to.
So what exactly, but what I'm saying is I'd rather have the scene at the memorial in whatever year it is rather than the scene in the bunker or whatever it is, in the trench.
Yeah.
Look, I don't know. I just
– although it does show – sorry, it does show that Tim is more the man and
than
the other Hutchinson. Bloke is – Hutchinson is just an idiot.
But no, I like all those endings. For me, it rescues this episode and brings it back up to at least an 8. I don't know. I mean, is this a weaker episode for you guys? Is it? Do you think you just see it as the one big thing? Like, you know, every week I kind of think the first part was stronger than the second part, although the back end of it was quite glorious.
I think that generally speaking, unless the second part decides to go in a completely different direction, which does happen, and it's something that Moffat in particular is very keen on doing, I think that just of necessity the second episode tends to be weakest in a two-part story. And, I mean, even in four-part classic Doctor Who stories, episode one always tends to be a little bit more fun. Here I think the problem is that the plot runs out a little bit too early and there is a little bit too much talking. But I think I agree with you, Todd. I think that those scenes at the end, my favourite of the final scenes is the one with the Doctor and Joan. I think that's extremely good. But all of them are great. And I do think, I mean, we've spent 90 minutes with these characters. Let's say goodbye to them.
Mm. Exactly. The scene you're talking about with Joan is definitely the best of them. And that is, I think, I wouldn't be surprised if it's one of those ones that Russell told Paul to put back in the story, because whilst I don't remember much of the detail of the book, the one thing that really stayed with me at the time and upset me a little at the time was when Joan says goodbye to the Doctor, not to John Smith, and it's sort of more set at the door. Like, it's, I think the impression is that he never actually gets over the threshold of the house, because I think she's living in a cottage, and basically she closes the door behind him. And I should have looked this up before the podcast, but I think the line is something like, it's a paragraph all by itself, and it just says, and she stood there for a very long time.
Wow.
And that really affected me at the time. There is some of that in that final farewell sequence with Joan.
There is a change, which Paul remarks on in the forward to the edition that I referred to last week. And in the original novel, she asks him if he can change back and he says no. But here she asks if he can change back and he says yes. And then she says, will you? And he says no.
Without a moment.
I think that's so incredibly good. Mm. That's so amazingly good, I think. And I'm not even sure what it's saying about the Doctor. I guess it bespeaks a bit of callousness or something like that.
Oh, but, I don't think it does.
Well, I don't know, because it's his, you know, he's being asked to give up his identity and his,
exactly,
his cape and his underpants on the outside,
exactly,
and all of that sort of thing.
Yeah.
But
who's going to do that?
It's so blunt. It's so blunt. It's really
it's so
good.
Blunt.
It's much better than saying, no, you know, the technology only works once or some nonsense.
Exactly.
It's much better to say, no,
no,
I'm
I
not
will
going
not.
To.
I choose not to do that. Despite what we had, I choose not to.
Yeah.
Picking up on your point, Todd, and well, both of your points about the strength of the episode, it's almost like there's enough content there for an old-style three-parter, like a McCoy three-parter. I agree that maybe the second episode is a little bit stretched. I agree, Nathan, with your point that the second episodes generally are going to be weaker because the first episodes, there's all that promise.
Mm.
And you know, the promise is never going to be lived up to, with the possible exception of Caves of Androsani. The promise is never really lived up to. Classic series stories, you know, the second half is always a bit, oh, well, okay, and then this happens, and then no, and then it's all over, and bang, explosion, the end. I look at it as a whole. I like to see the whole, both episodes as one story. I know that's not the fashionable thing to do with the new series. You want to sort of treat them all as episodes, and yes, this just happens to be sort of a two-parter, but I think the whole thing works as a 90-minute story, whether you break it down into two or whether you just watch it all in one hit. I think it works really nicely. I think that I don't know how Russell, how or why this kind of it happened in the Russell D. Davies era, but that thing where the first two-parter of the season is disposable and a bit stupid and, you know, is a run around and lots of explosions and things
like
that.
I think the word enjoyable is the word you're looking
and
for.
And then the second two-parter is – and then the silly is the word I was using. And then the second two-parter is got a lot more emotional depth in it. There's a bit more adult – in it. And then when I say adult, I don't mean sex and stuff. I just mean it's just more mature. The story, not only is the story more mature, but I think the emotional responses from the characters is more mature. There is nothing mature about Aliens of London.
No, I think it's got a serious political point to make, but it's a cartoon. And,
yeah.
And, you know, those ones are sort of Sarah Jane adventure style runaruns at the beginning of the series.
Yeah. And so it was like this was sort of when Human Nature came on, it was like, yes, this is. Now, it's completely clear, set in stone, that this is the way that a modern Doctor Who series works. Yeah. And the more interesting episodes tend to be backloaded in the season, apart from when you get to the very end, which is, again, another sort of stupid runaround. But it's like the way he puts together a season.
Yeah.
And I get that a story like this and a story maybe like Blink or something is going to maybe lose some elements of the audience that are just wanting the silly runaround that you're so fond of. But it's just that thing that this is what makes, you know, we needed more Doctor Who like this, not less. Even if there are little bits that I say that, oh, this could have been better if only they'd have done this and this is a bit dragged out, et cetera, et cetera. But overall, this is exactly what Doctor Who should have been doing and should continue to do.
All right, so it's part two, and so that means it's time for Picks of the Week. Do you want to start, Todd?
Well, I've decided, surprise, surprise, to choose a classic Doctor Who story as my pick of the week. And I thought about this and I thought I need something that's got a green glowing alien spaceship that sort of crashes and it's sort of a period piece and somebody slaps somebody else and the women are characterized in a certain way and there's former public school boys, obviously, in it. So I've decided to go with The Horror of Fang Rock. From the Tom Baker era, go and enjoy.
I think that's very good advice, Simon.
Well, if I was to choose a classic Doctor Who story as pick of the week because it's got a link to this one, it has to be Enemy of the World because of the main actor playing a different role. But I'm not choosing that. I'm instead choosing W1A, which features Joan, our very own Joan. Jessica Hines is in it as a sort of a marketing guru. It didn't really get much of a run here in Australia. It's the kind of thing you really have to track down. If there are any British listeners here, they'll be more familiar with it. But basically, Ian Fletcher, a chap called Ian Fletcher, who you'll recognise from Downton Abbey, who is formerly head of the Olympic Deliverance Commission, has taken up a position of head of values at the BBC, and it's got a wonderful yes minister flavour of the perils of bureaucracy and how everyone can walk around and nothing actually gets done. But she plays, it just shows the, how good an actress she is, because she plays a totally different role to what she plays here.
And is it like just a one series or?
I think there are three series. There are only a few episodes in each.
Okay.
Yeah.
Good. Look forward to watching it. Nathan?
I'm gonna choose the original novel by Paul Cornell. We talked quite a lot about it last week. I, at the time, often found new adventures a bit tedious. One thing that they had a habit of doing was introducing a whole heap of characters and settings that wouldn't pay off until the very end. And they didn't generally feel like works of fiction that merited quite so much effort on my part. And so, you know, occasionally they were tedious and eventually I did stop reading them. But they were what we had in 1995. And in fact, they were what we had from sort of 1990 to, you know, goodness knows when. And there was some extraordinary Doctor Who in that series. There was some bad Doctor Who as well. Mm. But human nature, I think, as you said last week, Simon, was really kind of one of the pinnacles of the series. And I think it's well worth experiencing in that medium if you've enjoyed this episode as much as we have, I think.
I look forward to reading it for the first time. I'm sure it's in my box in the attic, but I bought it, but I don't think I read it.
No, definitely read it. It's really, really good.
It is great.
Really good. Yeah. I'm looking forward to getting up to it if I ever get that far.
Listener, that's all we have time for this week. We'll be back next week to find out what the school bursar, Mr. Moffat, has been up to during those illicit trips to the pub. So please join us as we discuss Doctor Who's most savagely underrated episode, Blink. In the meantime, you can find us wherever you get your podcasts, and you can keep up with us at flightthroughentirety.com, Flight Through Entirety on Facebook, and at FDE Podcast on Twitter. You can also find our Series 11 flashcast, Jodie Into Terror, at jodieintoterror.com and at jodieintoterror on Twitter, and our James Bond commentary podcast, Bondfinger, at bondfinger.com, at Bondfinger on Facebook, and at Bondfingercast on Twitter. Until next time, may you fall in love with a charming schoolteacher who isn't secretly an alien from the constellation of Cerberus. There's a lot of us about. Thank you very much for listening, and good night.
There is. See you soon.
Bye for now.
That was Flight Through Entirety, starring Todd Bielby, Nathan Bottomley and Simon Moore. Theme arrangement by Cameron Lamb, strings performance by Jane Orberg. This episode, Six Bullets, was recorded on the 18th of August 2019 and released on the 10th of November. Fans of human nature will enjoy Series 12's upcoming TV adaptation of John Peel's War of the Daleks, which will remove every other Dalek story from canon except for the Wheel in Space, which doesn't even have any Daleks in it.
Nathan, I know that you really enjoyed the musical score for this episode. Did you want to talk about what aspects that you...
Look, I think that this is where the All the Strange, Strange Creatures track, Murray's All the Strange, Strange Creatures track really sort of comes into its own. And there's not really all that much more to say than that.
All right. Well,
do you have something to say about the music?
Absolutely not.
Because, I mean, it's...
You're a musician. You might...
I'm not a musician, but I will say that...
You've got an ear for music, Simon.
I will say that it's typical Murray Gold in that there are moments which are perfectly good, but then it gets too big and too showy in too many places. But that's just a general complaint about it. And that's not necessarily Murray Gold's fault. It's the fault of the style that they're going for, I think.
Have you seen Years and Years yet?
No.
Murray does the score to it, and I think it's just tremendous.
I'll be looking forward to it. It's definitely on our list. Yeah. Is it actually? It's not available here yet, though, is it?
No. Well, he did. I mean, he, you know, Russell brought him for Queer as Folk and stuff as well.
Oh, he's in Queer. He does good. Well, the Queer as Folk music is very good.
Yeah, I think that theme's like that.
I think the Murray Gold music we talked to owes too much to Dudley Simpson, and that's who I'm not a huge fan of either. Yeah. And so,
I guess I like that sort of more operatic. I mean, I think, well, that's what music's for. You know, tell me how to feel, Murray. Yeah. I'll cry, I promise. I think that's probably a tag, actually.
The endings, like after all of this.